Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life is an incredibly powerful story. The son of a German psychiatrist in an aristocratic family back in the early 20th century, Bonhoeffer made the unlikely decision to study theology. And in so doing, he encountered a Jesus who utterly revolutionized his life and would not let go of him. In this episode of Spiritual Life and Leadership, we speak once again with Brant Hyams, author of For a Better Worldliness, subtitle Abraham Kuyper, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Discipleship for the Common Good. Brant and I talk about Bonhoeffer's understanding of discipleship and how that understanding not only shaped the way he trained pastors, but also led him to participate in, believe it or not, a conspiracy against Adolf Hitler, a conspiracy that ultimately failed and led to Bonhoeffer's execution just before the Allies defeated Hitler. Bonhoeffer's story is a compelling one, and I'm really grateful to have Brant Hyams unpack Bonhoeffer's life for us. I'm Marcus Watson, and this is episode 21 of Spiritual Life and Leadership. Brant Hyams is my first ever repeat guest on Spiritual Life and Leadership. Hi, Brant. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks, Marcus.
Yeah. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
So just by way of reminder, a month and a half ago or so, Brant was here and talking about his book, For a Better Worldliness. And the subtitle is Abraham Kuyper, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Discipleship for the Common Good. And so we spent the last interview talking about Abraham Kuyper. And as I was reading your book, Brant, I remember thinking to myself, there's a lot of stuff here. I think it might be great just to focus one episode on Abraham Kuyper and another episode on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You said, sounds good to me. And so that's what we're doing. So today we're talking about Bonhoeffer. So I'm looking forward to that. But before we jump into that, you introduced yourself in the last episode you were in, but why don't you just give us a recap again of what you do. You are the assistant professor of humanities for Los Angeles Pacific University, and you're also the managing editor for Resonance Journal. Tell us a little bit about what you do and where you're at and stuff.
Yeah, so I'm on the faculty for Los Angeles Pacific University, and they're actually part of the Azusa Pacific University system. And LAPU focuses more on adult, kind of non-traditional learners and online. And so I get to live in Central Oregon in Bend, this beautiful outdoor mecca of adventure that I like to partake in as much as I can. And I get to work with students who are pursuing their studies. So
yeah,
enjoy that a lot. And then I'm doing work also for the Theological Journal of Resonance, which is a resource that we try to focus towards pastors and lay leaders, just to help cultivate conversations around theology and ministry and practice.
Yeah, awesome. And again, Resonance Journal is a great publication, all kinds of thoughtful articles, theological and practical in terms of ministry. And anyway, so good stuff. And I'll let you give us some links at the end of the episode so people can connect with that. So a couple of little fun get to know you questions. We did some last time. Here's a couple others. But let me ask you this. What is the most formative book that you've read?
Yeah, we're talking about Bonhoeffer, I have to say Bonhoeffer's book, Discipleship.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's just when I first read that in college, and then I started studying it more in during seminary, it just really grabbed a hold of me, and it focused my graduate studies, for 10 years.
Yeah.
It really was just a catalyst for me.
Can I ask you... I have a question out of curiosity on that book, because
sure.
I read that book too when I was in seminary. I think I read it the first time, but it was titled "The Cost of Discipleship." Why?
Right.
And in German, I think it's just Nachfolge or something, right?
Yeah.
Which is which is discipleship. But why? Right. Why do you have any idea why it got changed coming into English, or has it gone back?
So what happened was, it got changed initially. in the initial translations of it, I'm not sure the dates when it was first translated, maybe the 60s or earlier, it was titled originally The Cost of Discipleship, just because it captured kind of the major theme of the book.
Okay.
In the 90s, there was a large translation project, the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Works project, where there was a group that worked on translating all of his works, kind of doing a scholarly definitive translation of everything, updating everything. And when they did that series, the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Works series, that's when the title changed back to Discipleship, because it was more in line with the original German title.
Right. Yeah, interesting. And what was it about that book that was so formative for you?
For me, it was an articulation of a theology and discipleship that it was just powerful. It was a powerful articulation of the meaning and purpose and possibility of our faith.
Yeah.
To me, it was just a really clear. He just writes and describes theology and life in such a way that just kind of cuts to the heart of things.
Yeah,
and it's just
cool.
So almost brutally honest that
So. Well, good. And we'll be talking more about that throughout this interview. So kind of unpacking his understanding of discipleship. So one other quick little question. If you had to recommend a TV series on Netflix or Amazon Prime or whatever, what would that be?
Yeah. we watch Netflix. I appreciate more of the kind of, I'm into more of the, I don't know, let's say older, but some of the sitcoms like The Office or Parks and Rec. I also have been liking The Good Place, which is it's an interesting TV series.
Okay.
It's one of the network ones, but it's on Netflix.
It's like really with Ted Danson.
Yeah, Ted Danson. And it's just like one of the main characters is an ethicist. And, you know, it's just funny to.
Okay.
It's kind of a neat commentary on ethics and on heaven and hell.
Interesting.
And so that's an interesting.
Okay. Very cool. All right. I might have to check that out then. But yes, the Office is something that we also have been having on almost nightly these days. We're just like, let's pick a random episode of The Office and watch it. And it's like they just don't get old. all right. Well, let's get into talking about your book again. So the first half of your book focused on Abraham Kuyper. I'll put a link back to the other conversation that we had about that. I can't remember what episode it was exactly. I should look that up, and I'm going to do an edit right here. Okay, back from the edit. It was episode 15, and the title of that episode was Abraham Kuyper and Discipleship for the Common Good. And Abraham Kuyper lived around the turn of the century. You talked a lot about this and was involved in politics and leadership and was even prime minister, right, of the Netherlands. And so he had one way of kind of approaching discipleship, and then Bonhoeffer had another way Well, maybe you can help me understand, like, I don't want to say a different way of understanding discipleship, but there was something different about his understanding of discipleship. How would you characterize that difference?
I would say the main difference is the context.
Okay.
Kuyper is a Dutch Calvinist, and Bonhoeffer's a German Lutheran. So you have those kind of theological differences that we can parse out. Uh-huh. But I think one of the main differences is the time that they lived.
Okay.
Bonhoeffer had to face, Nazi Germany and the kind of threat of that. And really defined how he had to articulate and apply his theology.
Yeah. Can you, Brandt, give us maybe just a brief bio of Bonhoeffer's life and... that'll help us, I think, set the context to help understand his thoughts on discipleship.
Yeah, Bonhoeffer, he was born in 1905, He was six. I should know exactly one of those dates.
Right around there.
Yeah, right around there. And he was, kind of had the culture of the German aristocracy.
Okay.
His dad was a very, very successful psychiatrist, led the National Hospital and things like that. And so they were always entertaining, academics and whatnot. And his upbringing actually wasn't very religious, but at one point in his youth, he decided he wanted to be a theologian. And he started working in that direction and ended up being really influenced by Karl Barth and his articulation of God's revelation and kind of upending the prevailing liberal interpretation and application of theology. There's that kind of great theological debate happening with Barth and liberal theology in the early 20s, 1920s. And Bonhoeffer kind of got involved in that. And as he started doing, he was also brilliant. And so he worked, fairly quickly through his doctoral studies, started doing some lectureships at the University of Berlin. And as, he became more and more articulate, he also had this pastor's heart, and really, as the church situation in Germany started crumbling, he found himself in the midst of working to help establish stronger seminary education for pastors who could resist Hitler.
Okay.
So then he continued in that. And eventually found himself more and more involved, against Hitler, as the church, as the churches were eventually closed down, and anything other than kind of a Nazi sanctioned German Christianity was allowed. He found himself barred from teaching, barred from preaching, barred from writing. He had moved more and more underground. Some of his family members, his brother-in-law was a part of the military intelligence service, who actually they were working to stage a coup against Hitler. And so there was kind of this, the old German kind of military officers could see what was happening. They were trying to find a way to undermine Hitler. And Bonhoeffer got involved in that through his contacts. He had a lot of great international contacts through his work. He was really involved in the ecumenical movement before the war. And so as the war was coming, they used his ecumenical contacts as a way for him to be a double agent and go overseas and inform some of these overseas contacts about their plan to try and overthrow Hitler. And got more and more involved in that. Eventually was arrested after a large failed coup. If you've ever seen the movie Valkyrie with Tom Cruise, Bonhoeffer's character is not in that, but that episode he was involved with.
Okay.
And when that bomb went off and didn't kill Hitler, that's the episode that ended up getting Bonhoeffer arrested.
Right. I remember watching that movie and being so disappointed that they didn't even mention Bonhoeffer in there.
Yeah.
I'm like, come on.
Yeah.
Because what a great story that would be. Man.
Yeah.
Somebody needs to make a movie, all right, about that. That would be, I mean, what a story. Anyway, so pretty amazing life.
Right.
And there's sort of a transition that happens, right? In the beginning of his younger years, he had sort of a, I don't know, would you call it a seminary? There was Finkenwalde, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about what he did there and what he taught in terms of discipleship to his students there.
Yeah, so in about 1937, the Nazi church had kind of outlawed all kind of theological education and training that wasn't like sanctioned by the state. And so there was the evangelical Lutheran churches. They had to form an alliance. They called themselves the Confessing Church.
Right.
And they still wanted to prepare seminarians, to be pastors. And so they set up a series of kind of underground seminaries where they can continue to train pastors. And one of the, and they asked Bonhoeffer to direct one of them. It was at Finkenwald, which is up in the kind of northeastern part of the country, actually Poland today.
Okay.
Up by the Baltic Sea. I had the opportunity to visit there, the old seminary site. It's just kind of a field now. The building's not there anymore, but there's a little garden and a little memorial and a cross.
Huh.
And
how cool.
Pretty neat. But anyways, he led the seminary and really did it differently than the other confessing church seminaries, in that he kind of implemented almost a monastic ritual where he wanted to bring in, he really wanted to focus on kind of the spiritual cultivation of the pastors and not just the intellectual academic knowledge. He really wanted to find to bridge the two, because he knew that when these pastors left, so that they would come to him for kind of their final 6 months of their preparation before they were licensed by the denomination. Yep. So he knew this was the last opportunity he had. And then they would go off and they would be all by themselves in their church, parish, needing to have, you know, the strength to stand up to the impeding, you know, Nazi influences.
Yeah,
so he really was trying to prepare them in a way and to build a community. I talk about in the book, the House of Brethren, which was, you know, this kind of core community that stayed on longer to help each kind of class that came through for 6 months, to help them really feel established to the community so that when they left, they would continue to have support.
So a real emphasis on spiritual formation, in his seminary. Is that what he called it, a seminary or a...
Seminary.
And so Hitler had already taken control. I mean, he was already in power when he started this. Is that right?
Yeah, this was 1937. Hitler came to power.
Oh, 37. Okay, so he was well established in power by that.
Yeah, he was well established.
Yeah, and okay, so they were. So I wasn't sure, you know, if how much of an influence, like what was going on in politics, in the government, was affecting his the way he was training pastors. But it sounds like there was definitely a connection, or the government had an impact. The Nazi government had an impact on the way he was training pastors. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It was, I would say it would be a catalyst for how he,
okay.
The danger of the Nazi influence, you know, really.
Okay.
To pursue that.
Okay. And so eventually, though, his the seminary was disbanded. Is that right?
Yeah, so it got shut down. So eventually the Gestapo came and actually sealed the doors, you know, and wouldn't let, you know, closed it down physically. You know, he was issued a threat of arrest and everything if they continued to meet. But what they did is they moved the seminary underground, they called it. And they ended up for another 18 months or more, after they were closed, they found friendly church parishes, friendly pastors who would be willing to kind of, you know, officially take on an apprentice. But then Bonhoeffer would take on the apprentice, but then they would meet in a small house, you know, several of them, and Bonhoeffer would continue their course of study underground.
Yeah.
And then the war eventually started, and they all got drafted.
Right. Would you say that Bonhoeffer was pacifist? Is that
this is a great question. Because a lot of his theology is, you could make the argument, or a lot of people make the argument that he's pacifist. I call it more peacemaking.
Okay.
Rather than pacifist. That's kind of
okay. Interesting.
He's definitely committed to, you know, the way of peace through Christ.
Yeah.
But clearly he wasn't a pacifist. He was willing to engage in, you know, the assassination plot against Hitler. So one of the interesting things about Bonhoeffer, especially we can see in the last, you know, kind of the history of interpretation throughout the latter half of the 20th century and into now, is you have all these different groups kind of claiming him. You know, conservatives can claim him, pacifists can claim him, liberals can claim him, and so it's really interesting to kind of see the different groups of people that kind of glom onto a certain aspect of his theology and work.
Yeah, I think the thing that's really interesting about Bonhoeffer is, like, here's a guy who really had to wrestle with, how do I practically live out my following after Jesus?
Right.
And what's the best way for me to do that? And, you know, in one season of his life, it was, you know, having sort of the seminary and doing a lot of spiritual formation with young pastors in training. And then in another season of his life, it was participating in an assassination attempt on Hitler. And both of them for him was a form of following Jesus. Pretty amazing. I mean, in the kind of situations, at least the second one, one that virtually none of us will ever be confronted with. Right. But the challenge then is, how do we live our own discipleship in our own contexts, whatever context that is, and what does it look like in our context?
One of the themes in Bonhoeffer, I think, is really important in discipleship, is this idea of discernment. Mm. And Bonhoeffer really, I think, exemplifies just the necessity to have a spirituality and a theology that, and a practices of spiritual formation that allow you to discern what God is calling you to.
Yeah.
These pivotal times in his life where, he had to make certain choices and rely on the grace of God to carry him through.
Yeah.
But without that, I think without those practices and those theological foundations, discernment becomes more about me than about what God's calling.
Yeah, right. I think that's really important, right? Spiritual practices, ongoing spiritual formation, right, is what helped inform him and helped him discern. And probably at some point came to a place where he said, I don't know if this is the right thing, but I think this is what I would do anyway. Lord, I don't know if this is the right thing to do. I think it is. And if not, then, I trust your grace towards me. But
that's exactly it, is this trusting. You think about the assassination, the coup, obviously, so he comes to a place where he realizes, well, it's a sin if I do it, and it's a sin if I don't do it. All I can do is count on God's grace. To carry me.
It's true, and sometimes you're faced with what's the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
And he decided the lesser of two evils was to put an end to all the evil Hitler was doing.
Right.
And that meant trying to take his life. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Let me ask you a couple of, as I was reading your book, a few kind of phrases jumped out at me that I kind of took note of. And I wonder if you could kind of unpack a couple of these phrases. One is, and I'll just list all three and then we can talk through them. One is theology of life. You talk about Bonhoeffer's theology of life.
Yeah.
And then second one is God of the gaps. And I'm wondering kind of what does that mean? And then the third one is this worldliness. What does Bonhoeffer mean when he talks about this worldliness? So talk about a theology of life first. What does that mean?
Yeah. So it's really fascinating. Bonhoeffer, in one of his most creative times theologically, was when he was in prison. He spent this time in prison, and he was arrested for the conspiracy, but then he was in prison for quite a while before he was killed. He was moved out of prison and taken to a concentration camp and hanged right as the Allies were concentration camp. It's really tragic. But when he was in prison, he managed to get a steady supply of books sent to him for continued study. He would write letters to his family. He would request certain books. They would send books back and forth. And then it's interesting because they used those books to communicate. They would underline certain letters in the books. Mm-hmm. They had a system for communicating so they could keep their story straight with the conspiracy.
Wow.
And so that's enough. I don't talk about
that's
that,
fascinating.
It's a fascinating kind of way.
Yeah.
But anyways, some of the books he got during that time, he was trying to expand his reading and wrestle through some more ideas, because that's just the kind of person in theology he was, trying to think creatively and trying to, okay, this is the reality of the situation I'm in.
Yeah.
That the country's in. How do I make sense of this? How do I make sense of how God's working? So this idea of theology of life, some of the authors he read were Wilhelm Dilthey and Jose Ortega y Gasset, who were...
Okay.
I talk about this in one of the chapters.
Who
were philosophers of life. And they're really influential historically, philosophically. We won't get into them. But he was influenced by their writing and by their, and they weren't theologians. So he was contending with kind of historians and philosophers and looking at their ideas and seeing the real philosophical and scientific questions they were raising.
Yeah.
That often, and there was this recognition that more and more life was happening without God. And yet, Bonhoeffer was convinced that, you know, God was the center of reality, that Jesus Christ was the center of reality. So his philosophy of life, really, he affirms a lot of the conclusions that these philosophers make, but he does so in a theological way.
Interesting.
And so he doesn't take the end of their argument that, well, philosophy of life means that as the human in the center, you know, Bonhoeffer will say a philosophy of life means because God's the center, that's how we have life. Kind of a similar idea with the idea of this worldliness.
Okay.
Because recognizing that as science, and I'll get into this, also relates to the God of the gaps.
Oh, okay.
As science has discovered more and more, it used to be that our conception of the universe, you know, was, you know, God encompassed it all. God was the center. And then kind of as more and more scientific belief happened, what we would do is we would learn something and then we would fill in the mystery with God. And then as we learn more, kind of the gap, it's called God of the gaps because the gap between what we know and what we don't know scientifically is getting smaller. It has gotten smaller historically. Mm.
Yeah.
And so that explanation for God just keeps getting smaller.
Oh.
It says eventually God gets pushed out because the gap goes away.
Interesting. Right. So God fills in the gaps. When a God of the gaps is when you understand God as being not much more than an explanation for stuff that we don't understand.
Right.
And the more that we understand things, the less we need God.
Right.
Is that right?
And yeah. Yeah, that's right. And he's saying, you know, that's, he says what has happened then, or the ending of that is that God, you know, gets pushed onto the cross. And that's actually where the reality is. Like, it's okay that God gets pushed onto the cross because that's the definition of of the world that we live in. God is in the middle of this world. That this worldliness means that God is right in the midst of it in his suffering. In his understanding. And so it's not a disregarding of God, it's recognizing that no matter how small the gap gets, God is still in the midst of the world.
This So there seems to be a little bit of connection to Kuiper and Sphere. What is it called? Sphere, yeah, sovereignty, sphere sovereignty, perhaps. Yeah. Do you think there's a little bit of a connection there between the two?
Yeah, there's both. I mean, there's Kuiper's central piece of sphere sovereignty is the lordship of Christ kind of over all creation. It's a very positive, okay, triumphant view. And Bonhoeffer, yeah, is more kind of a, you could call him a theologian of the cross, where he sees kind of the suffering.
Right.
But both, this is why I like to hold Kuiper and Bonhoeffer together, because those are both images that we need, you know, as Christians and as theologians. Yeah. Like, we need the triumph, but we also need to recognize the power of the suffering and of the, how God has entered into the world. And so therefore we're not alone. And therefore that's how redemption.
You know, it is interesting. So, I totally agree. You know, we need both images of God, of Christ, the triumphant and the this worldly, you know, that he's in the midst of our ordinary, mundane, and even painful existence. It kind of, to me, reflects the impact of our context on our theology, right? Neither of them are wrong, but they are profoundly influenced by where they grew up, you know, what was going on around them, you know, the experiences that they had.
Well, even their traditions, I mean, yeah. Martin Luther is a theologian of the cross, you know, it's the So there's even that, you know,
Calvinism. Yeah. It just sort of reminds me that just because someone's theology is different doesn't make it wrong. It comes from, you know, we each have our own experiences by which we interpret the world and interpret our understanding of God. And, you know, if I had had so-and-so's experiences, I'd probably have their understanding of God too. And, and it's not necessarily wrong. Anyway, to me, that's kind of encouraging, and gives me hope that, hey, I can learn from someone with whom I disagree, maybe vehemently, as long as I remain open to whatever God wants to teach me through that person. Anyway, that's my little mini reflection on, a lot of what you just said. Yeah, that's cool. So theology of life, God in the midst of life, is that right? Or
God is. I mean, I just think that we just need to realize God, when we feel like God's far away in whatever issues or circumstances or tragedies, you know, just remembering that, to me, that this worldliness, like, God is right in the midst of that, like, suffering, you know, the suffering and the pain, and confusion, and, you know, the tragedy.
Yeah.
That's the cross.
And I think it's something that we too often try to keep at arm's length, right? That this suffering or this difficult season or whatever is not of God, we might say, but it might absolutely be an invitation to just experience God in the midst of that, and discover a whole new connection, a new depth of relationship with God, I think.
And it's also ultimately hopeful because of the redemption.
Let me ask you just one more thing, we'll finish up after this. You have a great definition of discipleship in the last chapter of your book, and maybe you can just kind of say a little bit about that, but let me read it to you and then you can unpack that a little bit for us. So here's your definition of discipleship. Discipleship is the response to the call to follow after Jesus Christ in all aspects of human life and endeavor, from the inner personal disciplines to the deliberate shaping of culture in the very midst of the world. Can you just kind of say something about that and unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, this is my attempt to synthesize Kuiper and Bonhoeffer in a way that, you know, provides a holistic understanding, you know, an explanation of discipleship. One of my underlying critiques is that our use of the word discipleship is too often limited, especially in church context, to kind of like a curriculum. you know, like here's a 10-week discipleship study on reading your Bible every day, which is important. And that's why it's part of my definition, the interpersonal disciplines, but it's just a piece of it. And so I'm really aiming at more of a holistic understanding. Discipleship first has to be a response to Jesus's calling. God calls us, and discipleship is how we respond to it. Right. It also has to encompass all aspects of what we're doing. It has to, you know, it impacts, my inner life, but it also goes out into the world around me, into the culture. You know, that's, and it affirms the world that we're in, and it affirms God's continued work in the world and his work towards redemption and his calling and how I discern and respond to that calling in the world. So it's really a call to this kind of holistic, deep response to what God's doing.
Yeah. And I like, you know, I really like you say from the interpersonal disciplines to the deliberate shaping of culture, right? The interpersonal disciplines. So I think about Bonhoeffer again, right? That was super important for him and his students, the interpersonal disciplines, so that I feel like one leads to the other, so that we can then participate in the deliberate shaping of culture.
Right.
And then in the very midst of the world, right? I love that you end with that. Where we are in the heights or the depths of whatever our context is, that's where we follow after Jesus. That's great. Well, hey, thank you for being here again and for teaching me and others who will hear this some more about Bonhoeffer and what it means to follow Jesus. Right again, I think about the subtitle, well, the title of your book, For a Better Worldliness, and then again, subtitle, Abraham Kuyper, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Discipleship for the Common Good, right? And really, that's what I'm reflecting again. Discipleship is for the common good, the deliberate shaping of culture. Anyway, Brant, thank you. I'm grateful for this book that you've written, and I'm grateful for you being here with us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Well, if you'd like to find Brant Hymes on the internet, you can go to the website for his book. The website is www.betterworldliness.org, and I'll include a link in the show notes to that. And then also, just by way of reminder, his book is titled For a Better Worldliness, Abraham Kuyper, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Discipleship for the Common Good. And you can pick up that book at Brant's website, or you can also click on the link in the show notes. I've also included in the show notes some links to some of Bonhoeffer's most important writings, namely Discipleship, Life Together, and Ethics. And I've also included a link to a collection of these books, which I found on Amazon at a pretty affordable price. Well, my prayer for you is that you would continue to draw close to Jesus, that whatever context you find yourself in, you would be able to discern how God is calling you to live out your faith, just as Bonhoeffer discerned how God was calling him to live out his faith in his particular context. And that's the challenge, isn't it? Right, to be so surrendered to Jesus that the decisions and the choices that we make in each season of our lives are the kinds of decisions that Jesus might have made. Thanks so much for being with us again today, and I will see you next time here on Spiritual Life and Leadership.